Well, hello, old friend. Hello, it's Paul Carenza here. Welcome to this podcast. If you've been here for some time, you might know that this began as the Heptagon Club podcast. It's been rebranded as a Paul Carenza podcast, so I could bring you some other things out now and then, including Comedians with Books. We did that for a few episodes. And then it's been sort of lying dormant, potentially on your devices, for some months, if not years. My main podcast now is the British Broadcasting Century, telling the history of broadcasting, the BBC radio and all those sorts of things. You're welcome to find us and listen to that. But I wanted to do something. I had to keep this podcast online. I had to keep on paying the monthly hosting thing just to keep it going. Otherwise, the old episodes vanish. So I was thinking, what can we do with a Paul Carenza podcast? It's a bit like what can we do with a drunken sailor. Basically, a Paul Carenza podcast is a lot like a drunken sailor. Well, on this episode, there might be the occasional swear word like a drunken sailor, because I decided let's keep it for some chats, because now and then I've been chatting with some comedians, not many, but just one or two who get in touch and say, hey, let's have a catch up. And then you think, we could have a catch up on the phone, or we could record it. So this is the first of an irregular series. It'll be very much now and then. You could go weeks, you could go months without hearing from anything here, but stay subscribed and then something will pop up in here, which on this occasion is an interview or a chat or just two people having a catch up. Now, unlike previous podcasts I've done, like the Heptagon Club or the New British Broadcasting Century, I'm not going to edit this conversation. I do like an edit, it rather trims it down somewhat, but sometimes you just want something longer form you can record and put up here. And jobs are good. So it's a long one. You can edit it yourself in your own heads, I'm sure. But this is a big old conversation between me, Paul Carenza, and comedian Dan Willis. Now, I started gigging with Dan about the same time as each other, back in the early noughties, 2002, 2003. And in this wide-ranging conversation that we had, we discussed, yeah, everything from those early gigs to what Dan's up to now down at Perth Fringe Festival. So I was in Guildford. Dan was in Perth in Australia, literally a world away, but united via Zoom. We've not actually spoken together for a good 5 or 10 years, probably, but we had a great catch-up, including also talking about when we both were part of the Big Brother house for a show called Kings of Comedy. It was a non-broadcast pilot. And we spent 1 week living in a TV studio together and with some other comedians. And there's one or two stories to come out of that. It's been a great pleasure to chat with Dan. And there will be more recorded conversations like this randomly pinging into your podcast inbox. If you can't wait that long, do find the British Broadcasting Century podcast. And you can find out all about the origins and the bizarre weirdness that began the British Broadcasting Company. For now, though, with a minor language warning, because it's easy to stumble on such things when you chat with people, here is Dan Willis.
I don't want to say the dreaded phrase, you're on mute, but you're on mute.
On mute. You can hear me?
I can. How are you?
You haven't changed a bit.
I know. There's a receding hairlines. That's the main factor here.
Oh, my hair started, but I got these pills and it all grew back again.
That's what you need, isn't it? It's all about, yeah, at some point you've got to resort to that.
Dry.
Yeah. How's it going? How's captivity?
Well, I've put shorts on especially for you.
That's very kind of you. So you're in, where did you say you are? Perth? Adelaide? Perth.
I'm in Perth, and then Adelaide will be happening after Perth, and then Melbourne Comedy Festival will be happening after that, hopefully.
Jealous.
Mind you, do you still perform?
I perform, yeah, but I've not done a Fringe Festival for a while, actually. I've done a couple of the small ones. I've done like Leicester because it's quite a good testing ground. But I've not done Edinburgh since, I think it's 2015. It was the Back to the Future 2 year. I had to do one because I did a Back to the Future based show. So 2015 was Back to the Future 2 year. So, but apart from that, only because I had to, no, I've not been back.
It just reminded me of another adventure with you. We did a preview together of your first ever Back to the Future show.
Yes.
I did my first ever solo show, Radiohead.
That's right.
I was lucky because I got to go first and the crowd weren't interested in anything and they vaguely put up with me.
Well, it's one of those nights, as I recall, where they didn't know it was Edinburgh previews. They thought, oh, it's comedy. We're just going to have a laugh. Yeah, and we arrived with notes going, right, and now an hour of this esoteric idea that I half thought of on the way here.
And believe me, I'm peaking after 6 minutes and I'm like, this is as good as it's going to get. Yeah. You've got another 54 minutes of this to go.
Those are long hours, aren't they? Was that, that was a, as I recall, that was like a South London pub kind of thing. Was that right?
It was out. No, that wasn't South. Oh, yeah. Do you know what? You drove. You had your friend, a very pretty actress, if I remember right, who played a part in your show.
Oh, yes. Oh, in which case, I know. So that was not South London. That was, yeah, because we drove together then.
North of London. So it was like north of like Luton. It might have been Luton or somewhere
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, might have been. Might have been, actually. Yes. Ah. But you're still doing festivals. I've stopped doing festivals because I couldn't hack the pace and the lack of audience numbers and the cost. But you are gone for it. And in fact, you're now in Australia and touring around festivals while we're sitting here in lockdown three.
All I do, I realized years ago, because I mean, I think you'll know this, and in comedy, your first 2 years are crucial to whether you're going to work or not. I mean, in my first 2 years, I got pretty much the only TV I was ever going to get. And then I just kept working, and eventually I got all the, you know, paid 20s and MC and jonglers and stuff like that. And I realized I was never going to make much money unless I started really upping my game. And I thought, fuck it, I'll...
You've got to do something, then. You've got to change up a bit.
Yeah, so I just moved to Australia and I started running shows here, producing shows. And now that's pretty much all I do. I produce shows, I perform. I have a world record, which no one else wanted, which is no one has performed more solo shows at fringe festivals than me.
Is that right? I didn't know that. Globally, like you've done them.
I don't think anyone globally is, because I've done, I realized like in Edinburgh in 2006, I realized that the only way to make money is to do more than one show a day. So I started doing two solos a day and then three solos a day. And then I did 1 year where I thought, I'm going to break through. And I did six solo shows a day. Completely different shows. Wow. It was like my back catalogue plus a new show sort of thing. And I thought, this is going to be great. And I got, because I think I spent something like £3,000 on registration fees. Yeah, I couldn't afford PR. So I spent so much on rego, and the press did not pick. I thought, if I'm doing six a day, the press are going to be on this, right? Mm. And I think I got four website reviews where they're like, oh, this guy did it. And I'm like, I got nothing.
I think this is what a lot of non-comedy people, a lot of muggles don't realise, is that if you've got a big agent, you know, you go to Edinburgh, you see the same names on the posters, the same agency, the same producers. But if you're like you and me, and you know, you've got to try something different and work hard at it. And the one that, you know, we'll both know, Yanni, comedian, who did that novel twist Edinburgh, I don't know, 5-6 years ago
think
now.
Big. It was Think Big, and it was about three Edinburghs ago or something. Maybe four.
So he hired the biggest venue in Edinburgh for one night only, didn't he? I think it was like 5,000 seater or something like that.
I think it's 1,500. It was a
1,500. Okay, it was a big one. But either way, it was a venue. There's no way he would normally. Jimmy Carr would normally play it. Yeah. And as a non-famous comedian, he was like, right, for one night only, come on, we are going to do our best to make this the most rocking gig ever. And I know that, you know, he struggled to get a crowd, bless him. And I was rooting him on. But it goes to show that turnover of the, you know, the mass expense that the big producers can throw at your show. You get all the PR you want, but it's going to be tricky to fill those big venues, isn't it? It's tough.
And I mean, I make good money in Edinburgh. In fact, it justifies the trip and everything from Australia now. But I've got a 300-seater free venue, and it does the business. And I do two solos a day, and then I MC a gig at night. And the MC gig is just at 7 p.m., and that's my walk-around money. Mm. Everything else gets, I'd like to say, banked. It gets cashed in a bag.
Right, okay, under the duvet, yeah, under the mattress. Yeah.
But, so that works for me there. But over here, I mean, I earn what I'd consider, I own a house here. I bought my mum's flat for nothing. It was an ex-council place in the UK. And I actually have a nice lifestyle paid for by comedy, but no one knows who I am. So... I perform a lot, I headline gigs, it's like, but I've never really, I think I used to want to be famous, but that was maybe just as a, I wanted to kiss more girls, let's say.
Well, why be famous when you can make a living, you know, if it's working, and, if it's working.
Yes. And now I'm happily married with a kid and a dog. What kind of dog you got?
We've got a cockapoo. So, yeah, I've just walked
in. How many cockapoos do I have? Everything, but poodles. Whoever's the lucky poodle is getting all the ladies.
I know. The thing is, I'm allergic to most things, and a cockapoo, it turns out, is like the only breed because it's, you know, been bred. The allergies are bred out of it. So that's the one I considered. I was like, that's it, cockapoo or nothing. And I'm now thinking we should have gone for nothing, but you know.
My dad has a cockapoo, and he got one about, I think it was about 4 months ago, because we got, we had a Ridgeback over here. And when she passed away about 5-6 months ago, we thought, oh, we'll get another dog. And I went, we're thinking about it. Then we found a Rottweiler puppy, and my wife talked me into it because she had a Rottweiler when she was a kid. I was still scared of them, to be honest. And so we got ourselves a Rottweiler, and he is huge. And he's 23 weeks old, and he's 30 kilograms already. And he's only about a third of his way through growing.
And are they deep down lovable little playthings that we just don't see normally?
Rottweilers are so easy to train. They use as police dogs in Germany and places like that. Well, they're from Germany. It's a German breed. And I did a lot of research, and they are soft as. They do as they are trained to do. That's why people can train them to be angry. Mm.
Okay.
And so if you properly train one and raise it, and so you've got to socialize it a lot. And he's great. Brucey runs around.
Oh, Brucey. You've got a dog called Bruce, and you're in Australia. How marvelous.
No, it's Brucey. It's Brucey. It's named after Bruce Forsyth. Brucey bonus.
Very good. You're up, man.
He was the best guest we had on the Gloria Hunniford show when I used to do the warm ups for her years ago.
Well, this dates it. This dates it. Brucey is a guest on Gloria Hunniford. Wow.
That would have been about 15 years ago, maybe longer, maybe even like 17 years ago. And it was great because he did everything. He just rocked up and he was tap dancing and he was running around cracking jokes. He did all my work. And I'm a lazy guy. So, you know, someone's doing all my work for me. He even did the commercial breaks. He was jumping up and going. And then I always remember because the next day we had David Essex on, who was lovely. But he's about 10 years younger than Brucey, maybe even more. Mm. And he was walking around with a walking stick, could barely stand up. And I was thinking, that's class A drugs for you.
Man. Well, time back to what we were saying about fame before. I've got a comedy writer friend, James Carey, who his theory always used to be, you know, we used to moan about the fact that popular comedians get onto sitcoms or panel shows, whatever. Yeah. But particularly that producers, when you're pitching a sitcom idea, producers say, yeah, but, you know, can we crowbar Jack Whitehall into this? Or can we crowbar, you know, popular comedian of the day into this? And James Carey's attitude was always, he had this thing where he said, the general public, you know, the comedy industry think that we've heard of these 80 comedians who are about to break through or have done Mock the Week once or whatever. But the truth is we haven't. And you can be on Mock the Week a thousand times and the general public have only all heard of Brucey. His thing was the only famous person in Britain is Bruce Forsyth. And now he's gone. So basically, this whole thing of chasing celebrities to be on your thing, thinking it will make it better, it won't unless you got Brucey. And from now on, unfortunately, you ain't got Brucey.
No Bruce Forsyth. This so we have Brucey the dog. He's available for everything.
There you are.
He's house trained, but he will get overexcited and piss himself if someone new.
If Gloria Hunniford were making TV shows today, I'm sure she would book him tomorrow. And in a accident, it'd be hilarious.
That was the first piece of regular money I got in comedy, the Gloria Hunniford show, and it was only 50 quid a day for doing, and it was five times a week because it was a daily chat show. And it was 2 p.m. in the afternoon. So it was just a regular 250 a week. And that when you're scraping through really does come in handy.
I think people don't realize how little people think, you're doing what, anything to do with TV, you must be raking it in. And 50 quid at the show is not what people expect, I think, of things.
The industry standard was a lot higher, but this is Channel 5 back when Channel 5 was in its infancy. So they had next to no money extra, you know. So it was a, it was actually, do you remember Ed Balls, who used to run the the Balham?
Oh, that Ed Balls, not the politician Ed Balls. Yes.
Yeah. He got me into it because he was a writer for them. He actually died about 7 years ago, I think. Okay. He moved back to Australia. I tried, and there's a sad story. I tried to get to his funeral, but I couldn't make it. Literally, I found out the day before when it was in Canberra, and I thought, I'll just go. But then I couldn't drive at the time. I've had to learn to drive since the birth of my daughter. And I was like, well, I just couldn't physically make it. So it's a shame. But he got me the gig, and it was great. Just jump out of bed at 1 in the afternoon, shoot down to Tottenham Court Road.
The good old days. Well, things are easier then. You know, you could lie in, you could do these sorts of things. You could even gig, which I can't do here now, but there you are.
But you've got it. You write for the BBC, is that right?
Yeah, so I've got, I mean, I wear a dozen different hats, really, but the gigging is, I do a few gigs still, but not as many. In normal days, I do about one a week, something like that, 1 or 2 a week, and I'm more solo stuff rather than the circus such. But yeah, a lot more writing, which is writing for, I've got like 2 sitcoms that I write for regularly ongoing, but that only takes up a week or two, you know, a couple of weeks a year really. And then writing for, you know, pitching my own ideas, writing books. I've just started writing for CBBC, a children's show, an existing one, so just I'm one of the staff writers for that. And you know, articles and stuff like that. So as a writer, it's like you need, you know, you just need, unless you're J.K. Rowling or whatever, or someone similar, yeah, just fine. I just got to work across 12 different genres just to make it all add up, really. You know,
it is. Right. Fine. I actually, I listen to Radio 5 Live quite a lot because it tends to line up with my daytime if I'm at the gym or if I'm walking out a driver. And it must have been a couple of years ago. I was driving home from a gig in Melbourne. It was like, I don't know, 1 in the morning. And you came on talking about Christmas books.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That would be me. Yeah.
I did not know you were an expert on Christmas, Paul Corinza.
Well, do you know, it's funny you say that. Neither did I until a few years ago. I've written a couple of books, but I wanted something a bit more historical because I like history stuff, but I'm a bit of an amateur historian. Wish I'd studied it properly at uni and all that. And I thought, I'm interested in Christmas and like the way it all links together and Dickens and not just the isolated trivia facts sort of thing, but the way it all links together. So the way that Dickens was inspired by Washington Irving, who sort of heard the Santa stories and started spreading that amongst kids and things like that. And it all links together. I thought, okay, well, I couldn't find the book that I wanted to read about it. So I thought I'll write that book instead. And, but it's all been part of a slightly calculated thing. I've not talked about this much really, but the Christmas thing, I thought I'm going to try and put a flag in the ground and be like the go-to guy about Christmas so that every year it comes around again, the phone will ring, Radio 5 Live, local radio, whatever, talk about history of Christmas, plug the book, and so it continues. And I'm now doing the same, but I've done Christmas, so I'm now doing the history of the BBC and the history of broadcasting, early radio, how we got to this point, how the whole BBC is based on basically 4 people having a few random ideas in 1922. And again, I'm trying to put that flag in. I've sort of got the flag in the air, and I'm still trying to just stick it in the ground. So that's why I've got this, I've got a podcast, a novel, and a TV show idea. I'm hawking around at the minute. Again, just because the anniversary of the BBC is 100 years old in 2 years' time. So by that point, my plan is, my goal is to get that flag in the ground. Boom, I'm the go-to guy for 5 Live, etc. to go, we need someone who knows about this. And it's the Christmas guy again. Let's get him back.
I tried to do that with computers a few years ago. I wrote a solo show because I used to be a programmer before doing all this. Did 10 years in an IT degree and then worked my way up. And I wrote a show called Control Alt Delete and thought that's it. Because I'd occasionally get booked for a corporate event and it would be horrendous. I'd turn up to, they go, oh, you're a computer guy. You know, you should. So I wrote an hour show and cut it down to half an hour to do corporate events, which worked great for about 4 or 5 years. And then I realized, like last year, I only did one last year and then I withdrew the show. Because I did the Internet Awards for Australia and none of them knew what a ZX Spectrum or Commodore 64. They had no idea.
Your references. Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I've got to rewrite this bloody show. I mean, I did away with it because I just went into a sort of clean stand-up comedy set.
Right.
But I was like, oh, now we've got to rewrite this thing now.
It's a changing world.
It's like, because sometimes you get paid stupid money. It's like Microsoft paid me like £3,500 to do their graduate intake. And those graduates had never seen a free bar before.
Right, okay. Like
200 of them.
They know a space bar, not a free bar.
Free bar. But Microsoft liked it because all of their managers were at the front and they were like, oh, Dan, thank you for doing that. That was good fun. And I was like, if you went beyond the second table, it was just like the last days of Gomorrah. Drinks getting thrown in the air and all sorts of stuff. So there's lots of money in it, but then I just kind of, a little bit of my soul dies every time I get booked for a corporate and I'm like, oh, I don't really enjoy them being in the diary and but I need the money, or I'd like the money all the time. And so I was the computer guy, and I tried to get, do you know what's the worst thing? I tried to, I pitched some jokes to the IT crowd. There was a writer in Edinburgh, and they pitched some jokes, and they didn't even respond, but they did make it into the show. So
no way. Oh, that's cheeky. That's cheeky. Oh man.
So I was like, okay. So here's what they liked. And then they popped up. But then BBC came for that show. The BBC came and put me on Click, which was massive. Yeah. That got me a lot of work. Because they literally came and wanted to talk about technology, and the interview went really well. So the actual bit ended up just me for 25 minutes on BBC Click worldwide. And I picked up a few gigs and got to fly around and do a bit. And then, as I say, that show is, I've beaten it to death.
Well, if your references are all like, hey, you remember Alta Vista and Ask Jeeves, then, you know, there's a new kid in Kent. You've got to learn what Google is. It's a new thing. It's a new thing.
Mine are older than that. Mine are like typing 10 print Dan, 20 go to 10.
That's my era. Amstrad CPC.
Oh, wow. How old are you now, Paul?
I just turned 42 last week.
Okay, I'm 47.
There you are.
So it is. I mean, nowadays, all the people with money in IT are in their early 20s.
Yeah.
It's a YouTube generation now. And I watch YouTube, I enjoy YouTube, but I know nothing about that.
Well, do you know what? And I can say this knowing full well, this video being recorded, mainly for audio for a podcast, but potentially this could end up on YouTube. So thank you.
Glorious masters.
But I, you know, I as a writer of sitcoms and things, I've occasionally, normally about three times a year, get a meeting with a production company or talent, or whatever you want to call it. I hate the word talent, as if we're not all talent, you know. But about, you know, can you write a sitcom for work with this person? We've got this thing we want to get in development. They normally never come to anything, you know. But I had one about 18 months ago, and it's the first time I was just stumped, really, because it was with a YouTuber. And it's with a guy who has millions and millions of followers. He gets every video put together, millions and millions of hits. And he wants to make a sitcom. But because nowadays he's, you know, the YouTube generation are, I don't want to say entitled as a negative thing, but, you know, they set their own rules, you know, whereas I'm used to, like, I go to the BBC and bow down and say, how can I bend over backwards to, you know, I want to adhere to your rules. Instead, we had his meeting at the BBC, and he's saying, like, I don't want to make a half hour show. I want to make a show that's as long as it needs to be. It might be 20 minutes one day, 38 minutes the next. And by the way, I own all the rights to it. I'm putting it on YouTube. And if you want it on the BBC as well, you can do that. But he was going in knowing what he wants. And the BBC were going, okay, yes, sir, please show us your ways, YouTuber. We do not know anymore how to reach these people who watch your stuff, because they're watching him and they're not watching classic, you know, traditional telly. So the BBC were totally in the palm of his hand going, you set the rules, we'll do it. Whatever you want, fine. And I just didn't get it. I was like, how do we write a sitcom for this guy when every minute is a different part of his brain firing off over the screen and in a different way? I couldn't.
Yeah, I look at things, you've got to be, I think confidence gets you pretty much 98% of the way there. And I always, back when I was getting meetings and auditions, I'd be confident on stage, but as soon as I got into a meeting scenario with someone that could make a lot of difference to my career, I genuinely just fold and turn into this, oh yeah, that would be brilliant. Thank you. Yeah, that would be all right.
This is it, you know.
Whereas, I mean, someone asked me a question, I'm not saying her name, because she's a good act and she's a nice person, but she gets a lot of TV, that particular act, over the last few years. And they said, well, how does she get that? I said, do you know what she does? She goes into meetings and goes, this is what you want. This is what's going to be successful. Blah, 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 blah. And she basically tells the producer that this is what's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I've been in meetings like that where you can feel the atmosphere change, because the person you thought was in the driving seat, the producer, the executive producer, the commissioner, suddenly gets, you know, you can almost see like the wind in their face as the talent comes in, the star name, whatever it might be, the writer, the creator, the comedian comes and goes, boom, this, you know, sorry I was late. Well, not sorry I'm late, I'm not sorry, and here's the thing, bang. And they go, wow, that's my world has been rocked. Please make 1,000 of these.
Yeah. And I've never been that person. And so nowadays, I mean, I produce shows and I fly people in from the UK and we put on shows and we tour them. And I got lucky with COVID because I'd finished two festivals. And then Melbourne Comedy Festival got cancelled. Obviously, Edinburgh got cancelled. And any gigs got cancelled. But I'd earned about half my annual salary by then. So I was basically okay. That's why.
Yeah.
At the minute, that's why I'm here in Perth, sat in a hotel room, just waiting for to get released on Saturday.
Yeah.
Funny, the police came around today, the Rozzers. They came around and they're banging on the door and checking that I was in here. And
oh, good. Yes.
I thought I was out on lunchtime on Friday. And they were like, no, midnight. So I lost another show.
Oh, no.
I canceled the show.
Were you tempted to do the knock on the door and you tempted to do the hello, this is a pre-recorded message from Dan, he's not here right now, but etc.
They've all got guns, pepper spray and all sorts of stuff here.
Yeah, don't mess.
And it's sort of juggling. I just realized I've got it written down so I don't forget them. My favorite Paul Carenza memories, I've got them for you.
All right, go ahead.
I am very disappointed by the fact that you're hardly ginger anymore, Paul.
No, it's going, gone. Yeah, shocking, isn't it? Well, you know, I used to do a joke about the fact that you don't get any ginger people over the age of 40. And the joke was like, you know, so what happens? They go grey, they go bald, or they just die. They just, you know, get to like 39, that's it, you know. And how we're going to wear the squirrels, the greys are chasing out the reds. And sure enough, you know, it's, I don't know what I am now, it's sort of brownish. It's just boring. It's just dull. It's not the fiery red it used to be.
There's no just for men for gingers.
It's not, is there?
There's no like, if you like to go back to ginge, and it's like, oh my word.
Yeah.
But no, I remember because you may not know. Do you remember gigging at the Purple Turtle?
I do, yes. Paddy.
That was one of the first gigs any comedian would do in London because they'd answer the phone.
Yeah.
And they'd quickly write it down. Yeah. So the bar staff would answer the phone. It was a bloody horrendous gig. I think I did it about 12 times and probably enjoyed four of them.
Yeah, they were nice people, but the gig was not pleasant. Yeah. You know, nice to work for, but that was it.
Yeah. And I think the idea was they put 15 acts on, and that's probably 12 drink sales.
Right.
A few more, you know what I mean? I think that was the idea. And I think that generally worked. But I remember I did about six gigs. I ended up doing a laughing horse gig. And this woman said, oh, that was quite good. You can come and do my gig. But I'd like to see you again to make sure. And I've forgotten her name, but she came to see me. I was an idiot. I said, oh, come to the Purple Turtle. And you went on and did quite well.
Oh,
and
thanks.
I thought, this will be great. Right? You did your Churchill impression.
Oh, no. Yeah, still do it.
And then I went on and I panicked because no one was, there was just other comedians and I'd never been at a gig like this. And I ended up saying like, some punchline to do with some joke I'd written about pregnant women on the tube, right? It was terrible, it was hack, it was whatever, but I'd been about 6 weeks. And it was like, it finished with, take that, you pregnant bitch, or something like that, right? It was like, that was it. She was like, no, I can't book you. You said pregnant bitch. And I was like, and then she went to you and booked you. So I was like,
Right. Oh, in which case, I know who it was. Yeah, I know exactly who it was. And trust me, the gig I ended up doing, you didn't want to do anyway. It wasn't worth it.
You know, You don't know these things. You don't know these things at the time. No. And then I've got there was this horrendous. There are good gigs as well. Mm. I remember you playing. You played the BBC Comedy Awards. I went down and watched that.
Oh yes.
And you did your Who Ate the Sum of All Pies or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Still got that in the boot of the car. Comedy. You never know when you need it.
Oh yeah. And but then I remember we went to this terrible promoter who had he had loads of gigs for about 3-4 months and they were all paid.
Mm.
And we went out in the middle of nowhere to do this gig, and you were emceeing, and he made you go onto an empty room.
He did. Now that was Deal. I still tell that story. Yeah, that was Deal in Kent. And I wrote it up in my book, the first book I did. So a comedian walks into a church. I wrote up that story, but I changed the location to Wales, I think, because it just suited where I was in the story. But actually, yeah, that was Deal in Kent, and it was. Yeah,
I remember because I mean I used to be friends with Mick Coppin, who and I call the Scottish comedian. We're not friends anymore, but that's but and we you know you'd think your fellow kid because Kevin Precious was on as well. I think there was Kevin, Nick, and me, and you.
Yeah,
and you'd think we'd be supported, but I was so I get embarrassed for I've got empathy too much of it, right?
Right,
and I get embarrassed for sitcom characters when something embarrassing happens. I hate it. I'm like, oh, I'm going to switch over. So when you were sort of like going on stage, I just went to the toilet. I said, I can't watch that. I was the least supportive person.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Well, do you know what? While you've been talking, if I've looked distracted at all, it's because I remembered I've got on this computer, and I only found this the other day, I used to keep a list of every gig that I'd done. And what I've got is the gig number it was, so first gig, second gig, third gig, so up to about the first 1,000. The dates, I rated myself out of 5. For some of the gigs, I put who I was on with, where it was, how much I got paid, and where I was in the bill. And sure enough, if I search for Dan Willis, the first gig I've logged you as doing that we did together, it wouldn't be the first one we did together, but
yeah.
The first one I noted you down was, Friday, October the 3rd. I don't know the year, probably 2003, 2004. It was my 307th gig. It was me and it was Coppin, as you said. It was Kevin Precious, Deal in Kent, 80 quid to compare. So there you go. That's what I was after. That was what I was paid to go onto an empty room because everyone was in the pub next door and the promoter was trying to lure them in. And true awful gig.
Oh man. And then we spent 4 days in the Big Brother house together.
We did do that.
Yeah. And I always remember.
Before you do the Big Brother, let me just, because I forget otherwise, I've just searched for your name on this gig list. And out of interest, the next one I've got, just see if this sparks anything. I'll come back to the Big Brother in a second, just while I've got this.
Yeah.
398th gig, Thursday, May 6th, the year after that. Willis, Henrik Elmer, Michael Legg, The Buzz Club in Manchester for Agroman. Do you remember that gig? I don't. But
yeah. I remember all my Buzz. I got in with The Buzz only about a year before they closed down.
Oh, right.
So it was one of the nicest gigs you could do. I remember that one very well because Agroman wasn't there.
Okay.
And I introduced you and Newcastle were playing on the TV. So I knew you'd be on for 20 minutes. So I went downstairs to watch the football for 15 minutes, right?
Mm.
And the barmaid comes running down and goes, "Where are you going? Where are you going?" I was like, "Well, Paul's on for sometimes they're awful. They have to be dragged off." And you were having a great
gig. You've seen me before.
That's but not this one. So that she literally insisted that I stood next to the stage.
Well, I get that at some gigs, when the bouncer looks you up and down and they say, it's five to get in, and go, "I'm one of the comedians." And they look at you and go, "You don't look like a comedian. Don't look funny." So the barmaid must have looked at me and thought, "It won't last 20. Yeah. No, get the compare up.
Because the Buzz was lovely. I remember the first time I did it as an open spot and Jim Jefferies was closing.
Mm.
And I had a really good gig and Agroman gave me 30 quid, whereas he was only going to give me a tenner. And Jim's like, you'll expect it every fucking gig.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really nice. And then he booked me. And then I probably got about maybe 4 or 5 gigs out of the Buzz Club before it sort of stopped.
Yeah,
they tried to bring it back as the Zub Club, but when it's such a shame when a lovely club just stops existing.
It is. It was a nice gig. Worth travelling to, all the way to Manchester just for that. But I've got you down for two more on the list. Friday, September 30th, a couple of years later, probably 619th gig. GSOH Weybridge that I used to run. It was me, you, and Robin Ince, apparently.
Yeah, no, I remember that. That actually got reviewed, that one. I got a review of it. Yeah, I did say it was a nice one. I was filthy as hell. I do nowadays have a really filthy set and a clean set, but back then...
For the Microsoft then, gigs. Yeah, okay.
I mean, I was represented. Were you represented by John Briley?
I set that gig up with John Briley. That was our gig. And one of my big regrets is that we... Actually, it wasn't the Weybridge one. We set up another one in Epsom in like an arts centre gig. And I was regular compere there, but I had 1 week off. And I was fine. I could have done the gig, but I was a bit under, I think I had a bit of a cold or something. I thought I better just stay. I mean, nowadays, of course, you come down with an allergy, you stay at home. But back then, a bit of a sniffle, you might do the gig because you don't get paid otherwise, you know. But I thought, oh, yeah, I'll have a night off. And it was Danny, what's his name? Danny, someone who was a replacement compere. And he had the glasses, he did a lot of jongleurs gigs. It used to be the joke about the helicopter. He used to misuse compare references. That's a whole other story.
You know what? He used to be the bane of my life, not for any bad reasons. I was a dickhead, and I would be like, why is this guy? Danny James?
Danny James. Let's say James. But he was replacing compare, and I found out the next day that my granny and granddad, who lived nearby, went along that night to see me, and they'd never seen me on stage before. And they thought, we'll go along, but we won't tell him we're coming because we don't want to freak him out. We'll just sit at the back. And they watched the entire show waiting for me to come on. And for a while, I think they thought they knew I was going to be compere. They're looking at Danny James going, is that Paul? It doesn't look like Paul. And I found the next day, it's like, I could have done the gig. And it's like the one gig, the one time that either of them ever came to see me perform and I wasn't on and I just had a night off for a cold, you know. So instead they saw Danny.
My grandmother, you see, I liked Danny James, but back then he used to have ridiculous stories that would just...
He you know, had like, stories. Like, that is you true. Know what I mean? He had stories.
And I'd just roll my eyes and I'd be like, oh my God, really? You dated Princess Diana, Kylie Minogue, you wrote the new James Bond theme and all that.
All of those are true. I'm not true, but all of those. He would say all of those. All of those. It's, yeah.
And for some reason, I thought to myself, I can't... And other acts have done the same to me, where they just don't think I'm a good act or whatever, and they've given me a bit of a back room. It doesn't bother me anymore. It's all water off a duck's back. But back then, I'd get like, annoyed. But because I was represented by John Brightley for about 2 or 3 years, and then we had an acrimonious split. And I don't think he'd say nice things about me nowadays. No. You know, it's like, it was all right.
He's
and,
doing wrestling promoting nowadays, I think.
Yeah, he'll be making a lot more money with a lot less stress.
True. Yeah.
Because, Paul B. Edwards, who remains a good friend of mine, he said to me, Dan, when you're promoting, the worst thing about comedy is dealing with comedians.
Right. That's a fair point.
And I can say, given that even though I'm stuck in this room, I'm promoting and producing shows at Perth Fringe from my room, and it is the worst. They are all idiots, including myself.
Yeah.
And they drop out and drop, and it's just, you know, it's like just ego city. And you're just like, oh my word. And there are wonderful people, and I'm not saying any of them are bad people. It's just, you know, I have to deal with about 20 a day.
Right.
And my mates rang up, another comedian, Terry North, and he goes, I should be all right. He's stuck in Adelaide. He arrives probably Sunday. And he goes, I've got Rory doing that. I said, really? Rory's doing your gigs on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday? Your gig that's exactly the same time as mine, and Rory's meant to be emceeing it. He's like, Rory, should it be all right?
Is this the comedians?
This is all feasible. It's all working. And I'm just like,
all chances. Can't trust them.
But
I want, before you can tell me the Big Brother story any second, but one last gig I found, which it was me and Dan.
Keep pumping them. I'm happy.
This
I'm
is
doing
the last one I've got. The last one I've got that I noted down for yourself as well. And in fact, it was earlier than the deal one. I've just found it was early. 265th gig I did. Sunday, March 30th, I rated myself 2 stars out of 5. Not a good one. Quite a few of us on this. Dog Bites Man was the gig. I got 25 quid for doing 20 minutes, and it was me and you and Paul Arnold and Petrie, which must be Ed Petrie, Nick Revel, someone called Shuff. Don't know who that surname is. James Davis and Clara. So there you go. That was a show.
Dog Bites Man was an that was Clara and Steve Carling used to run that gig.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
And it was, you know, that's where I learned to do longer sets at that gig, because they were both good friends of mine. And I'd go down most Sundays to see if they could put me on. And then it became sort of like they used to fill the room really well. And then they got a warning off the council for putting posters up. And it was sort of one of those posher areas of London, you know, not allowed to put posters up and stuff like that. And it started easing off. And then there were weeks where there hardly any comedians would turn up, but they'd maybe get 4 or 5 people in. So I'd go on and just do like 35, 40 minutes. And it was sort of, that's really where I learned to pace a longer set, really, because I was doing that once a week for about 2 or 3 months. And then they just gave it up because there was no money in it.
those were the glory days of when the London comedy scene had a lot of gigs, and most of them paid either at least a drink or a tenner maybe, or 20 quid or whatever. Whereas nowadays, it's all, you know, there's not many gigs, and it's bring a friend. And I mean, right now they're all closed anyway, but you know, when it was open, it wasn't the glory days of...
you know what's funny? I used to say, oh my God, if I'd started 10 years earlier, it would be easy. It would be a breeze. And then I was chatting to another British act last year, and they said to me, oh, I wish I'd started 10 years ago because it was really easy back then. And I'm like, I started 20 years ago.
There's a saying, what's the best time to plant a tree was 10 years ago. The next second best time to plant a tree is right now. So it's like, you know, it was always better and easier 10 years ago in whatever you're doing, I think. And not, you just got to get going before it's another 10 years go by.
Absolutely. So it's a, I do love it. So you're married with children now, is that right?
Yeah, married with children. My wife's at work at the local hospital where she's been working last year. And the kids, that we've got 2 homeschools happening around me due to schools being closed for pandemic-y reasons.
I strangely see you as a good homeschooler.
Well, I mean, I'm good in that I leave them to it. The video calls are happening. I'm using this right now. Our video call is via my phone's 4G, so that the Wi-Fi is left free for the kids, and then the teachers can do their thing. So there
we go. I'm a terrible. We only had proper lockdown here for about 2 months, if that, and so I had to do probably about 6 weeks of homeschooling for my 6-year-old daughter, and. The teacher would send the lessons, and you'd have to video a certain amount of videos of them doing the lessons.
Oh, okay.
And after about 3 days, I realized I could just cheat. And
that's a good lesson for your kids.
So Dolly, because she was only 5 at the time, she's 6 now, and it was all simple stuff, you know, and spelling words and this and the other. And I'd have the cheat sheet there, and Dolly'd be like, oh, I missed that, and she'd be reading it. But every so often, she'd pull the cheat sheet into shot. And I'd be like, oh, we're going to learn
things.
It was like boom, dropping in.
Exactly, yeah. Fix it in post. You know, yeah.
Oh, my word.
Speaking of TV, Big Brother House. Let's talk about Big Brother.
Well, this is years ago, Endemol, prior to every single Big Brother, they will do a rehearsal week as live. And so there are lots of people that have done normal Big Brother. I think the worst one to do is I'm a Celebrity. So you go down, they do that in Australia and have a week of I'm a Celebrity with all just normal bods like me or you. And you have to eat all the crap. And you just get paid like $100 a day for doing it, you know.
And not be on telly.
There's no fame. There's no
fame. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it's possibly the easiest TV gig I've ever got, because I got 2 emails. One was from John Briley and one was from Hills Jago. And it was like, John Briley goes... I know, I did the Hills one first. The Hills Jago one went, I've been approached by a production company.
So these are both comedy promoters who normally would book stand-up comedy nights and things, yeah.
You know, and back in the day, I got on well with both of them, and I've never fallen out with Hills. And John, you know, you represented me, and it didn't go well, and you know, we ended up going our separate ways. But Hills was like, oh, this producer and la-di-da. And so if you send me your video, I will peruse it, and then I shall send it to the producer. Mm-hmm. So she's holding on to all of the cards, yeah. Right? It was Briley moment. Yeah, I've been approached by these guys. Here's Endemol's address. If you want to get in, just give him a ring.
There you go. That's the difference. Right there. That's the difference.
And so I just sent them my Comedy Store video on VHS. And they rang back a day later and went, you're in. I think they literally gave it to the first, what was it? Eight of us, I think.
Yeah.
And we did that for... And do you know what? It got it out of my system. Because I always wondered... what it would be like to be in a Big Brother sort of house, and
and you can't manufacture that experience. You know, you think, oh, well, I'd like to see what it's like to write a sitcom. You can write a sitcom if it's never made, but a thing like I'm glad to have done it because it was a once in a lifetime experience live in a TV studio for a week with cameras behind mirrors that you could see the cameraman. You could see him as you're brushing your teeth on. You know, weird
and. I did enjoy it, and it was nuts, and it was crazy because I'd literally had a very short relationship with Karen Cockfield.
That's right. I'd forgotten that we went in, and we only realized when we were in there, like, oh, well, at least two people here have been in a relationship, because it turns out the comedy world is a small world. So, and the producers had no idea.
It's a tiny world. it wasn't like a, you know, we dated for a couple of months and then we stopped dating. You know what I mean? So, and it was Karen would laugh because she was like, oh, I can't believe you considered a relationship. Last time we met up for a drink years ago. And I was like, oh my God. But so it was just straight in. And then it was having to write stuff every day. And I really enjoyed working with Anna Curl. And it's 15, 20, 18 years ago, probably, I think. And we kept meaning to do something together. And I haven't seen Curly Whirly for years.
Yeah, I was in touch recently. She's down in Cornwall and gigging a bit. And where possible. Yeah, so there's a good bunch of people. Yeah, Anna Curl and Matt Dictinsky. And
Matt's in Perth now. He's a radio DJ.
Yeah, he was always meant to be a DJ. I could tell. He had the voice.
It was one of those experiences I'll never forget. I realized you could open the toilet if you gave it a solid kick; it would just bounce the lock open.
I knew this was going to come up. I knew this was going to come up.
I'd be waiting, and I saw you get up for a midnight shit, and it was just gorgeous. It couldn't get it any better. And I let you settle. And then I just gave it a kick and it just flew open. And I've never seen anything brighter in my entire life than a near naked Paul Carenza.
Do you know what, though? I've retold that story recently. I'm doing a Monday Facebook live show throughout the last year for lockdown. And, you know, it was a half hour thing and we anecdote a week. And I thought this will test me, rummage around the brain for some anecdotes. And I told that story about 10 weeks ago, but I never realized there was like a calculated, I'm going to let him settle kind of moment.
Because
when I retell the story, from my perspective, the locks we knew were all faulty. I'm on the loo and suddenly the lock, which is out of reach, it's quite a big bathroom. And the bathroom was the one room without cameras in it. And
it had a microphone right that held you right in front of your face.
Yeah, except there was that. So you had to be careful what noise you made. But then I saw the lock fall to the floor. And as far as I was concerned, it was someone just trying the lock going, I don't know if someone's in there. And then bang, door opened. And then the worst of it for me is that from across all through the hall down into the kitchen, I saw this camera slowly angle around and as it zoomed in across to see this open bathroom door of just me going, hello. And
because it was so there is film footage of you on the bog somewhere. And because it was sort of like that, because Russell Brand was presenting it.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was the first time that I realized he was really good, because I'd seen him do some awful gigs. I saw him at Late and Live in Edinburgh, where he was just abusing the crowd. He had fake blood patches all around him, so he started smashing glasses on his stuff.
That's right. Yeah, I was there too.
And I saw him at the Ballon Comedy Club, before I was a comedian. he did the Saturday night, he did an open spot on Saturday night at the Banana Cabaret. And honestly, it was dire.
Mm.
And you could tell he was feeling really bad. It was just that he started singing a song about killing Jill Dando after he was already dying.
But those people, the fearless comedians, are often the ones who, they will divide the room into like the 99% who hate them and the 1% who do. But if that 1% builds up slowly, they get themselves an audience and then they get to become Russell Brand and that sort of thing.
He's amazing. I'm a fan nowadays. I've only met him once since. We did a gig like somewhere outside of London, like Worthing or somewhere like that. And he was really nice. And I said, oh, we've met a couple of times before in Edinburgh, which is true. But this is back when he was heavily into his Class A's and stuff. And he was like, oh, God. And he said, I'm just going to apologize right now because I right. will have done it.
He's settled a lot, hasn't he, nowadays?
Yeah. It was an experience for me being there and that was probably the only real decent TV I've had, I think.
I know that my show reel on YouTube, which is well overdue an update, but I've not done a lot of TV in a while. I've been behind the scenes for many years, but it opens with the clip from Kings of Comedy because it's my name being called on stage because it was the Big Brother house going into a comedy club. So you'd leave the living room door and you're on stage, you know, and the opening clip of my show reel is Matt Dictinsky responding to the fact that Russell Brand's just gone, Paul Carenza, and Matt Dictinsky going, go on without your shoes, it'll be funny, because I'm wearing a suit, but no shoes, because I was not ready to go on yet. I was still getting dressed, you know. I had to walk on stage carrying my shoes, going, where can I put these, you know? And, an odd experience if you walk out of a room of your house into a comedy club where there are 100 people there waiting, and it's like they've been invited into your home. And in fact, nowadays, with a lockdown situation, that would be quite welcome. I could build a little comedy club and you're on, that would work.
It wasn't, I think they made the big mistake with that series because it was a bit of a flop, the actual series itself.
They did one series on TV, didn't they?
And they let the comedians out at the weekend,
to gig. It wasn't any sort of sense of sanity or going to see the family. They wanted to go and do some gigs, didn't they?
Yeah, and I think that was their mistake because after 4 days, you're in this environment where you sort of like, you feel like you're changing and you're reacting within it. And it was always weird because every so often there'd be something like a plumber would fall through a door and go, whoa, and go running off. And he'd be like, whoa, something different has just entered our zone sort of thing. Yeah. And I think letting them out the weekend and back in just ruined any form of social interact. They were never going to build that Big Brother feeling by releasing them out.
Well, we went a bit mad, didn't we? I know you were doing jigsaws as you're doing now in self-isolation. I was building a child's toy for about 3 days. Jigsaws we go. And it did stir crazy insanity, did sort of kick in. And I remember distinctly the rap part at the end of it, because you think of, you know, I'd only seen, what, three producers, a production assistant, a couple of camera guys and Russell Brand and the audience. But then at the rap party, end of the week, when people had been evicted, you know, one or two of us had gone early, whatever, and at the wrap party, you've got about 200-300 people there, vision mixers and makeup and sound, everyone. And they kept coming up to me saying, oh, do you know what? Well done for doing that. A highlight for us 4 days ago when you were caught on that toilet. Oh, we had a laugh at that. And I thought, oh, I forgot. I wanted to forget this. And like 300 people came up to me at the wrap party and told me how hilarious it was when I was caught on the toilet. Just glad it was never properly broadcast.
It never happened. Yeah, I remember because everyone jumped a taxi back to London. They all we'll get a taxi back to London. Me and you stayed in the hotel.
Yeah,
we had a few.
It was a nice hotel, a proper hotel. After staying in basically, it was the Deal or No Deal studio, wasn't it?
It was fantastic, and we got absolutely slaughtered. And do you know what? They put me. I think you got also. We both got a suite with a jacuzzi. If I remember
rightly, we did. And these are the good old days.
Was drinking with us, and I was like, because it was the only hotel rooms they had left. They put us into, right? And then the head of Edinburgh was buying us drinks, and I said, "I've got a fucking jacuzzi." And he's like, what? And I'm like, yeah. And I had this plan of I'm going to wake up in the morning and instead of a shower, I'm going to have a jacuzzi. And we drank till like 3 a.m. and I was screwed. I was like, in the morning, all I could do was throw a bit of water on my face. Yeah. And just,
that was just a weird experience, wasn't it? And you come back and just try and rejoin society after 8 days in the Big Brother house. And no, and but it's not like you could say, and you saw us on TV, because it wasn't. It was then replaced a week later by other more famous comedians. Yeah, Andrew Maxwell did it on TV, and Mick Miller.
Boothby did it, and Boothby Grafoe, Ava Vidal was on.
That's right, David Copperfield, the non-magician version. And
So was I? Yeah, no. You know, it's one of my favorite experiences because it is something that I actually kind of wanted to do, and I ended up doing it without all of the. You know, being on TV with it.
Yeah.
Although at the time I was desperate to get some TV, which I'd do TV now if it came my way. Obviously, I'm not an idiot, but it's not as crucial because I know how much money I'll make out of producing, promoting, and performing, and that is plenty. Mm. And it's just I would like to be richer. Yeah, it'd be good. And maybe, but over here it's actually, you know, when you say in the UK, oh, it's got to be one of these top 80 comedians. Oh, we need this, and then we'll put him in this sitcom, we'll put her in this sitcom, we'll do this. Over here, it's like 8 people get all of the TV work.
Right.
It's such a small margin. And so, you know, and they won't mind me mentioning the names, like Adam Hills, Dave Hughes, and I've just forgot Julia Morris. Do you remember Julia Morris?
Julia Morris, yeah. I remember Julia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's massive over here. She presents loads of stuff.
Well, clearly, and Adam Hills, who's doing the same in Britain as well, he's got to pick a lane. You know, you can have one country, but it's greedy to have both. Yeah.
Well, you know, talking about the BBC for it, I didn't even realise this, but the two Ronnies used to do the two Ronnies in the UK for 6 months and then come to Australia and do the two Ronnies in Australia for 6 months.
Didn't know that. Didn't know that.
There you go. There's that's an absolute BBC fact for you.
That's what Bruno Tonioli does with old Dancing with the Stars in America and Strictly. You know, it's cleaning up by doing both. And they're even overlapping. Even you film them both at the same time. That's why last series he was stuck in LA. Because I can't fly back twice a week like I normally would. You think, oh, come on, just do one. Give something to the rest of us. Not Bruno, but you know.
I know, I agree with the... Don't do it. I mean, I look at it over here and there's some incredibly rich comedians and I'm like, could you just take maybe 6 months off?
Yeah.
6 months. Just a little bit of a go at this. So like, the good thing about Perth Fringe, it's a good and bad thing. Very few comedians have made it. Even from Australia, you can't travel interstate, which is why I when they cancelled, it was... Let me say, no. When there was one single case of COVID in Queensland, and it was in Brisbane where I don't live, I live in the Gold Coast, I knew that Western Australia would shut down because of this one case they found. So I got on the next flight, and whilst I was in the air, they shut down. So they let me in, but I had to do 2 weeks quarantine.
Yeah.
And so there's very few comedians that sales are going well, but I do think that... the lack of choice isn't a particularly good thing for the crowds.
Right, of course. Yeah.
There are loads of shows and the big comedians haven't bothered with it because I was talking to Token, who are the Avalon equivalent over here, and they chose not to send any of their acts. So there's no big hitters at all.
Right.
So like, you know, imagine in Edinburgh without any major acts soaking up the crowds.
It's like the good old days. It's like the 50s. Right.
Yeah. Well, do you know, it's like when Frank Skinner first went to Edinburgh, I remember reading in his book, he had a couple of days that were quiet, but there was only 60 shows.
Yeah.
So you had a good chance.
You do all right.
Of going, getting loads of people. And people would go and attempt to see every show in Edinburgh.
Well, this is why I stopped doing Edinburgh, because when it jumped, when I first went, there were a few hundred comedy shows. And when I last went, there were a few thousand. And I just thought, there's not, the audience isn't growing to the same extent the number of performers are. And we're just getting fewer and fewer people to share around each year. It's just not doable.
It still amazes me that people will opt to do paid Fringe and lose £10,000 because they see it as you've got to be seen as moving up the levels and stuff. Yeah. And it should be, oh, you know, it's all image. I mean, a friend of ours said to me that, you know, his actual girlfriend, who's a well-known comedian, paid for him to do the paid fringe because she was sick of him not doing the paid fringe.
Just get out the house. Go out there.
No, she was like, you know, you need to be seen as going up in the full image.
Yeah.
And da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And, oh, no, I think she was up in Edinburgh as well doing a show.
Fair enough. I see. Yeah, okay. But, just to do it, just to move on up. Yeah. It's a bit of a sunk cost effect, isn't it? You just got to sunk the cost into it. I just need to get it working next year and move up.
People go to me, you're good enough to do the paid fringe. People who come see my show over here, and I'm like, yeah, but I just don't justify it. I've got Yorkshire blood seething through my veins, and the concept of performing and not getting paid.
Well, yeah,
someone's making money. I mean, a friend of mine, Nick Cody, who is a great Australian comedian, he sold out Edinburgh and ended up with a couple of $100 in his back pocket. He was shocked, and he was selling out 100 seats a day. So it's someone's getting that money.
The most I've ever made at Edinburgh was when I did Free Fringe and put a hat round, and it was a nice venue and I had a nice show, and I was getting £150 a show probably, because it's a free fringe, but you put the hat round, everyone puts a couple of quid in, you get a nice bucket talk, and you know, forget your coins, put your notes in, you're getting fives and tens, you know, a few years ago.
I say to him, I've got loads of bucket lines, but I'm like, you know, my favorite one that I wrote, got one of my street entertainer friends uses it now, which is you know what? Don't worry about it. If you can't, it's a free fringe. Don't worry. You don't have to put money in, but please do come and say thank you. So on the way out, if you don't want to put money, it's not a problem. Just shake my hand, say thank you, and feel dead inside.
But you know what? Now I'm doing Facebook live shows every week, and I'm saying to people, you don't have to, but you can pick your own ticket price, paypal.me, Paul Carenza, whatever, Patreon. The bucket talk is coming back. Now it's online, you know. So
I show photos of my daughter, man, because I do multimedia. Oh man, it's a at the end, she's getting a bit big now, but it was a beauty for a few years. At the end, I'd go, oh, you know, I talked about it during the show, and in my Whinging Pom show about Australia.
Yeah.
And I might get 300 people in this, in the liquid rooms in Edinburgh, sorry. And I'll show you my daughter. And there's a cute little photo of her. She goes, oh, she's all like this. It's like, oh, there she is in a playpen. And she's looking at me going, oh, daddy, what will happen if they don't put enough money in the bucket? Yeah. I'm like, oh. Well, what will happen?
Put on those heartstrings.
And then she's like, then I go and I say, oh, well, we might have to sell your playpen. Don't worry. She's like, I love my playpen. I said, don't worry, we've got your old one. And then I just put the photo and she's just sat in a box. it gets a nice laugh, but they know, hey, and I got the worst review in Edinburgh one year. For you, I don't know whether it was because I used that, but she mentioned that in the review. It was like one star Broadway baby, something like that. And she literally called me a dodgy uncle. It was the worst. Honestly, it was the worst review. And I'm like, oh, whatever. You know what I mean? And I looked at that day, and I looked, because I keep a track on how much money I get off the audience, and I got like 380 quid that day. And I was like, well, can't have been that bad. You know what I mean? And I remember that.
Works all right. Yeah.
And the show went well. And in Edinburgh, the most I've made was when I did 6 shows a day. They were all free fringe. And I'd probably make it. I made something like between 600 and £1,000 a day in cash.
Wow.
And if muggers had any nouse about it, they should have mugged me after the 6th show, because was just... I didn't have enough time, because I was doing so many shows, to cash it up or put it anywhere other than my backpack. And by the end of the 6 shows, that backpack was just full of cash.
Look through the fringe guard, look at the reviews, go, that guy, there it is.
Yeah, he's going to have tons of money. And say, if you're a burglar, you should burgle in Edinburgh during the fringe, because that's where all the mid-fringe, you know. Burglar comedian's flat, there will be tons of cash in there.
Logging into the bank, exactly. Yeah. I'm going to have to wrap up soon because recording space is limited on my computer.
No problem. If you want to talk about something specific at some other point, I would research it and then we could talk about it. It's not a problem.
The other thing I was going to say, I could use a little bit for my British Broadcasting Century podcast. If you have any early memories of broadcasting from, you know, TV, radio, anything that is just the old inspirational classic memories.
It's wonderful. TV used to be... Do you know, it used to be such a big thing, and now you've got everything. You've got the choice. You've got. One of my best friends, one of my best mates, and you guys, we have the same experience that our TV was taken from us as a child, was repossessed we were in Newcastle. I was watching Play School, I think it was, or Play Away, but. I do remember the sun. I think it was Sunday mornings were the big way. I'd sit and put the test card on. I knew what time Bagpuss was on, and I knew what time Mr. Ben was on, both of which lasted about 4.5 minutes. They were the shortest shows ever, but I loved them. And I'd wait watching the test card, knowing that the first thing on BBC Two would be Bagpuss or Mr. Ben, and then I think on ITV. TV didn't start till about 11 in the morning. And the first show on a Sunday would be Tarzan. And it was just a cartoon and it lasted about 50 minutes. And it was just great, that anticipation of something that's going to happen, a TV show. And you had to be there to watch it. I mean, obviously we got VHS left, but with me, this is what YouTube has done for us. Like, for instance, one of my favorite shows in my teens was Quantum Leap.
Oh, yes.
And I realized I'd never seen the final episode because I'd missed it.
Right.
And you go on YouTube, you could just watch it. It's easy.
Yeah. It's amazing that nowadays it's so easy. And back then you would have probably paid 50 quid for a copy of it or something. And nowadays it's just there.
I know we're getting towards the end, but I also realised that I'm running out of power on my laptop.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, we're also. So it is the end, though, and TV was just such a wonderful... I mean, it wouldn't be irregular for someone sort of show to get 20 million viewers on a Saturday night. Mm. And in the USA, which has got 300-odd million people, 20 million is like the most you'd ever get for a TV show. But it would be regular, and it would be Saturday night, Palladium, whatever. And I mean, I remember as a kid, I was watching when Tommy Cooper died. I was watching that live, right. And I didn't realise. And it was my granddad that pointed it out. He was something's happened. Yeah. But BBC, the educational programmes I used to watch as a kid, and I should have thought about this more because
that's all right. That's absolutely fine. Well, there's plenty there anyway. But if there's a particular thing we can revisit,
that's
great. I only need a minute or two. I've got for each episode of that. So that's the Tarzan, the Quantum Leap. And I should say as well, tying together the big budget 20 million viewers and the YouTube thing. The other day, I watched a full episode of Noel's House Party. In my head it was like the theme tune would summon me from across the house to go and hit that sofa. As a family, we watched Noel's House Party, and watching it back, and the episode I saw on YouTube was one of the late series where the studio was cut in half, you know, and shrunk because of budgets. And you think, my memory of this was like golden, the best Saturday night telly could get. And I'm watching it now on a small screen on my phone on YouTube in a small studio, and it all feels smaller. It felt big back then, even though the TV was smaller than the one I currently have in front of me here. But
Evans was the king of Saturday night. Mm. He's probably been one of the most consistent from the Swap Shop days. I think Noel Edmonds was on Swap Shop, if I'm right.
Yeah.
And Saturday Morning Kids TV. And he was consistent. The House Party was entertaining, you know, straightforward, not too... Mm. And now Ant and Dec are in charge of everything, aren't they? They literally do
everything. This is it. And in fact, only yesterday, I was walking the dog with the kids, and I explained to them, they're talking about game shows and Cracker Jacks that's back on TV nowadays. And I went through with them all of the things that Noel's House Party used to do. Gotchas, MTV, Grab a Grand, Wait Till I Get You Home, with the interviews with the kids that would embarrass the parents. And they'll go, is there any more? Any more? And they were hungry to know about these just silly, inventive, fun game show things.
My favourite, because they actively had Gunge. There was Gunge in Old Time Coffee. And there's not enough Gunge nowadays. Slime is huge with kids. They love it.
That's how we got onto it, in fact, because I was telling them about this Netflix show, The Floor is Lava, which, because they play The Floor is Lava at school, that you can't touch the floor, you've got to move from chair to chair or bench to bench. And I said, you know, there's a show on Netflix that does that, but they fill the studio with lava. And they're like, what, actual lava? I went, don't worry, it's going to be fun. There's a thing on TV called Gunge, Noel's House Party, and we went from there. You know.
Beautiful. Your kid, how old are your kids now?
They're 7 and 10. So they're just getting into more, let away from children's shows, into a more family-based, you know, we watch a bit of Strictly together. We watched a few things together now. So
we introduced Dolly, my daughter, to Monopoly over Christmas.
Oh yeah, we just did that as well. We've just started Monopoly. They love it.
Oh, she had a breakdown. She's been used to kids' Monopoly, which is a doddle.
Yeah, right?
And there's no tactics. It's just you roll the dice. You put a little cat, a little dinosaur in. But her grandpa destroyed her, and I've got a video of her. Jeff Greenlow. Do you remember Jeff Green?
Yeah.
He lives in Melbourne, but you know, he's a good friend as well. Yeah. He loved it. I put the video of Dolly up. He's like, oh, and she's like, I don't have the money. I said, you can move. I don't want to mortgage a property. I can't grab that.
Granddad means business now. This is it.
Yes, indeed. All right, Paul. Well, it's been a pleasure, man.
Nice to see you. Thank you so much. Thank you for being part of this. And I wish you well in your remaining days of isolation. And may you have great comedy waiting for you at the end of it all.
I get to go out for 2 hours tomorrow to get my COVID test.
Oh, nice.
Freedom. I was tested last week, and I don't think anything's happened since last week. So I get another test tomorrow, and then I can leave on Saturday. Just saying to the UK, this is how you control COVID.
Yeah, we're looking and learning.
Let's all go out.
We're looking with envy. We should get there. We should overcome. Stay well, stay in, stay safe, stay funny, stay laughing, stay everything.
Always a pleasure, sir.
Speak to you soon. Take care. Cheers, buddy.
So that was Dan Willis. Thank you, Dan, for that time. And thank you for listening, if indeed you have. And if you haven't, then you won't hear this bit anyway. Stay subscribed and other random conversations like this will pop up into the inbox. I think the next one will be with Mr. Tony Vino, good friend of mine, and he's been on the Heptagon Club podcast before. You can still find the old episodes of the Heptagon Club there, or you can find my new podcast, The British Broadcasting Century, and I'm doing Facebook Lives every Monday or Tuesday throughout the lockdown pandemic-y period. So do find us on Facebook. My Paul Carenza page is where you can find PK's Uplift Live every Monday evening, a live show of fun and or games. I hope you're doing well. Feel free to drop us a line and maybe you could be a guest on the next episode if you fancy that recorded chat to be like Dan Willis and the many others who may or may not be popping up here on the next weeks, months. I mean, let's be honest, this could be a series of two or three. Let's hope it's not a series of one. I don't think that's technically a series, but I have plans. One or two more chats will appear in the coming weeks and months anyway. Thanks for joining us. Stay subscribed, but mostly stay well, stay happy where possible. Have good days, bad days, sometimes very bad days, but know that we will have some good days again. God bless you. This is Paul Carenza saying goodbye.